Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to be taking a look at some legal issues, and for one thing, look at whether or not it's smart to get insurance through a rental car company. Mike Riley back with us, Madison lawyer, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Always great to have Mike come by, and certainly we can talk personal injury cases with you. Have you been offered mediation? What legal questions do you have? What about rental cars and insurance? Join in the conversation. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Mike Riley, welcome back.
Great to be here, Larry.
Lots of people are going to be going on vacation in the next few months and will be renting a car, and they will be asked for sure, pretty much, if they want insurance on the car. Should they take it?
Well, I'd love to say that it's a real simple answer, and it's not quite that simple, but certainly there are real basics we can talk about. First, that insurance is obscenely expensive. I once had an agent try to explain to me that it was a good deal, and it's literally 20 times what you'd pay through your own insurance company to buy insurance coverage, probably more than that. I mean, it's just bizarrely expensive. So the general, to me, you don't want to take it unless it is really necessary. And generally speaking, it's probably not. And, you know, having said that, like any lawyer, you know, there are caveats. The big thing to me is this, is go out, talk to your own insurance company. I spoke with a local agent who represents a bunch of different insurance companies, and he told me that the vast majority of the companies will take care of you if you're involved in an accident. There are really two components to this, and when they try to sell you the coverage, they'll talk to you about both. One is the liability coverage, which is coverage that protects you against a lawsuit if you damage somebody's car or injure someone. There's almost no question that your insurance company would cover you for that, that your company would take care of that. The bigger issue is really the collision damage waiver, which is not exactly insurance, but it's that coverage where they say, if you're in an accident with our car, if you damage our car somehow, if you take the waiver, then you won't have to pay for that. We'll take care of it. Most private insurers would also cover that. If you have auto insurance and you have collision coverage, which is the relevant coverage, they would take care of that. They'd say, okay, this is a temporary substitute vehicle, and we'll take care of that. I would always recommend that well in advance, don't wait till you're going on vacation in 2 days and you're doing 20 other things and forget it, which is what I usually do.
Yeah.
Ask your agent well in advance. Call them, talk to them. If you don't have an agent, call the company directly and say, hey, I need to know that will I be taken care of? If I have a collision, it's my fault. There's damage to the rental vehicle. Will you take care of that? Second thing is a lot of insurance companies will actually provide coverage if you use their card to rent the vehicle. So check with your insurance company and see if they'll tell you that, yes, we'll take care of any damage to the vehicle if you rent the vehicle using our credit card. So things like that are really important, and you should do that well in advance. But again, the general answer is your own company will take care of it. Now, when I talked to the agent, he said, you know, once in a while, I just do it anyway for peace of mind. And I understand that. And if you choose to do that, that's up to you. But the bottom line is you're paying a heck of a lot of money on a daily basis, because that's what it is. I mean, we don't buy insurance on a daily basis. We buy it, you know, monthly, annually for most of us. And it's a much better deal that way. And it really, the collision damage waiver particularly is really expensive. The other parts, the liability coverage, that your carrier will almost certainly cover, although it doesn't hurt to ask. And again, buying it through them, most of it is actually supplemental. So they usually, and we've talked about this before, Coverage on the car you're driving is primary. So if I'm driving your car and I get in an accident, your insurance company would come in first. Mine would come in second if they needed to. Yeah. But with the rental car company, it doesn't hurt to ask either, are you going to be primary on this? Because normally I think a lot of their coverages are not. They're saying it's supplementary. The collision damage waiver is just what it sounds like. They're saying you get in a collision and that's it. We're not going to, you know, we'll take care of it. You don't have to worry about it. The one other caveat, and again, I know this gets just getting, is the thing why people say, maybe I'll just do it for peace of mind. But the bottom line is you really generally don't need to do it. I know somebody had a question about what happens if you hit a car. That's the collision coverage, and that's the part you're worried about. I mean, if you I had a partner years ago, wonderful guy, judgment a little questionable at times, rented a moving truck and was going under that underpass on just off University Avenue, forgot he was driving a rental truck, took off the top of the rental truck. And the problem is not only do you have to pay for the damage if, you know, your company may not cover that, even though they might cover a car because it's a temporary substitute. If you're using a moving truck, they may not regard that as a temporary substitute because that's a little different ballgame, obviously.
Yeah.
So if you're going to rent to move your student or move your student moving yourselves or just moving yourselves, bear that in mind. That's one where it may well be worth taking the collision damage waiver or, again, making sure that your company tells you in advance, we'll take care of this if something happens. I'm not sure your rental car, you know, that your credit card will take care of that one either. It was a lot of money. We had a long fight, I can tell you, over it.
Well, Jill in Galena, Illinois has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jill.
I have a situation that has bothered me for probably about 15 years. I lived in the city of Chicago. We have great public transportation, so I did not have my own vehicle. If I had to do a bunch of errands, moving things that were too big to take on the bus or the L, I would rent a car for the weekend. And I did that. And I always took both the liability and the collision insurance because I had no vehicle of my own.
Yeah.
Well, we got hit by a guy. He T-boned us running a red light and took off. The car was totaled, and I ended up, the rental agency took me to court. And they ran me around like 8 different times. They had me go way out to the suburbs, taking like 5 different public transportations to get there. And they would always ask for a continuance. Well, finally, when the judge refused to grant anymore, he asked the guy from the rental agency what they were looking for. And he said they wanted me to pay for the car. And what my side was, I took both insurances. That's why I had it. And he said it doesn't cover the rental car because I was hit. I didn't hit someone else.
Oh, that's outrageous. And, that's stupid.
Well, the judge actually called. It was on the contract at the very bottom. It looked like it was just dirt at the bottom. It was so tiny. The judge actually called for a magnifying glass to read it. And he said, basically, he said that that's outrageous. You can't do that to people. And he made me pay the deductible, which I was willing to pay anyway.
Sure.
But I'm just wondering, is that common or were they kind of being a little bit sketchy there?
I think they're crooks.
Yeah.
I mean, that's awful. That's just ridiculous. First of all, you know, collision coverage is just that. Collision coverage is there so that if, you know, one, you cause an accident or somebody causes an accident who isn't insured and you can't do anything about it, then, you know, that's what collision coverage is for. There shouldn't be a deductible on the collision damage waiver. That's the whole idea of the collision damage waiver, is they're waiving any claim for collision. And certainly that's a good question. I'm glad you raised it. A good question to ask the agency. Now, if you use your own insurance, there will be a deductible, certainly.
Sure,
you know,
of
just
course.
Like there would be on your car. But on the collision damage waiver, in my mind, there should not be a deductible. I don't know which company this was, and we don't have to identify them, but it sounds to me, just as you said, that they were giving you the runaround. They thought they could kind of pull the wool over your eyes and the judges, and good thing that the judge was smarter than that, and most of them are.
Yeah.
Rental car companies are not the most sympathetic folks in the world.
Jill, thanks for calling. I appreciated that story. That was an interesting one. Man, Dale in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Dale.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two things. Quick, kind of related to that. My insurance man always told me to take out the extra insurance on a rental car when you go out of state and go on vacation because there's just less hassle dealing with your insurance man, their insurance man. And number two, I had the misfortune of getting in an accident with a rental car, and I took out the insurance, and that accident did not go on my accident report here on my insurance, which kind of saved me one year when I had to put a couple of claims in, but it didn't go on my insurance as a claim.
No, and those are good points. Well, the second point's a really good point. You know, again, the likelihood that you're going to be in an accident that's an at-fault accident, which is really what should go on your record and might cause some concerns with your insurance. If it's not your fault, it shouldn't matter. If it is your fault, it if it were in state, it probably wouldn't matter that you had insurance through someone else. It would make a difference that you didn't make a claim. Anytime you make a claim, it's going to have some impact, whether it's immediate or down the road. But yes, it's going to have some impact. So from that, you know, that's a consideration. The cost of the coverage, like I said, is just so unreasonable. I've said many times, you know, if you guys had charged a reasonable rate, you know, if it were $7 or $8 a day, which would be more than ample, I wouldn't have a problem. It's usually about three times that. You know, it's usually more like $20 a day, which is an awful lot of money. The hassle thing, you know, I understand that. Some of that, with all due respect to your agent, could be a little self-serving because part of the way agents get paid is how much profit there is on the business they send to the company. So they'd much rather you didn't make a claim. You know, and again, maybe that has nothing to do with it. I don't know your agent. You do. And he may be a great person. She may be a great person. I will say that, you know, it is strikes me as a bit self-serving. I'm not sure how much more hassle there is one way or another. But again, that goes back to what I said, that even my own agent said, well, sometimes I take it just because, you know, it's less, you know, it just gives me peace of mind. And if, the amount of money they're charging you, if it gives you peace of mind to take it, take it. I'm not telling anybody, whatever you do, don't do it. I am saying it's grotesquely overpriced.
Thanks very much, Dale, for calling. Diane in Nina emailed to say her 17-year-old high school son wants to take a babysitting job this summer, helping out two middle school kids. Part of the job would be driving those kids to baseball practice. What things should she put in place to protect her son and herself in case he has an accident while driving with the kids?
It's one of those things I talk to your agent about just to make absolutely certain nobody can argue that's somehow a business pursuit. I don't see that happening. I've never seen them raise that defense in that, and I've had cases in that kind of context where a babysitter's driving someone. The biggest thing is, one, make sure you've got adequate liability limits. As we've said before, nobody should ever have less than $100,000. It doesn't cost that much more. And in a situation like that, I'd look at an umbrella policy. Again, umbrella coverage is not terribly expensive once you purchase the basic coverage. It's certainly worth having, you know, God forbid something would happen where there would be a terrible accident. It's not at all likely. It's highly unlikely. But, you know, it's unlikely that our house is going to burn down too, and we still carry insurance because it can happen. So make sure you've got enough liability, underlying limits, and then look at an umbrella. That would be the thing to do. He's a permissive user. I'm assuming it's your vehicle, not his. He's a permissive user. He's covered as a member of the family, period.
Mike Riley, our guest today, Madison lawyer he's a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm, started here talking about rental cars and car insurance. We'll take other questions as well, and you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Michael Riley, Madison attorney and senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. We'll take some more calls now. Madeline and DePere up next. Hi, Madeline. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I wondered, has anyone in the state of Wisconsin ever won a lawsuit against doctors or a hospital? And if you just have a general idea, like how many there might be, is it a good chance that you could do that?
The answer, unfortunately, is not. And the answer is that your chances against the doctor are much worse than they are against any other professional and certainly most businesses or anything else. And that's not unique to Wisconsin, but the track record in Wisconsin is not good. It's easier generally to sue a hospital. I don't mean easier. It's not hard to sue a doctor. It's very hard to win. It is somewhat easier to prevail against a hospital if there's a nursing error or particularly if it's something you're being transferred and somebody drops you. I mean, those cases are much different. But when you're talking about medical negligence, which is what you're doing with a doctor, those cases are very expensive. They're hard fought. They're difficult to win. Some settle, but it's a very small percentage compared to the normal. The normal run of cases, 99.5% settle. With cases against doctors, I don't know the exact statistic, but it's way less than 20% at any rate. The cases have for years been handled by a specialized group of lawyers on both sides, but the plaintiff's lawyers, people who represent injured people who handle those cases, specialize in that, have a great deal of knowledge, are generally very good lawyers. And given all that, the success rate is still well less than 20% when the cases go to trial. And, you know, you can speculate all day about the why that is. It's clear that doctors get a great deal of sympathy. It's also true that jurors just don't understand medicine.
Sure.
You know, I'm a lawyer. I've dealt with it for years. Ask me how much I understand. You know, I know more than probably the average layperson, but it's very easy to create doubt. And it's very easy for the defense to bring in any number of doctors to say, oh, these things just happen. That's the classic. Well, this is an expected risk of the procedure. You know, and that's the defense that you hear all the time. You also get a cause defense that even if they had done something different, the outcome wouldn't have been any different. That happens a lot with failure to diagnose cases where the argument is they should have diagnosed something earlier or should have provided alternative treatment. And the defense can argue both that, one, they weren't negligent, but two, that even if you believe that for some reason they should have done something more, it wouldn't have made any difference anyway. And, you know, it's very hard to find witnesses to support plaintiffs in those cases. It's very expensive to do that. So, one, it's extremely difficult to find a lawyer who will take a medical malpractice case unless it has very strong facts and the damages are, you know, multiple hundreds of thousands, probably have to get a million or more before people are willing to undertake both the risk and the expense. So the short answer after all that is it's extremely difficult to find someone who will sue a doctor. And if you do sue a doctor, it is very difficult to prevail. I don't want to discourage anyone from exploring the possibility, and you should certainly consult a lawyer if you feel like you have a legitimate claim. People should be aware that it is difficult to get someone to take them and very difficult to prevail.
There you go, Madeline. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Mary in Lanesboro, Minnesota, a chance to join in. Mary, hello.
Hi, Larry. This is Mary. I have a question about adverse possession. I have found myself in a situation where I've had to file a complaint against a neighbor, so I'm acting as my own attorney in this, and I don't have the, you know, any kind of legal background. And I've gone on to some of the government sites in terms of how to explore, the process and all of that. And all of them seem so technical that I find it difficult to understand. Is there any reference that you could, a simple language, a way to give me more understanding of how to approach this? We are scheduled for a hearing quite soon, and then a trial. And I'm looking forward to this process. I'm looking at it sort of like taking a college course in adverse possession in the legal system. Can you give me any ideas on where I can go to find some resources?
Well, there are a couple things. I mean, one, I certainly, in this world we live in, I'd go online and Google some of those things and look at adverse possession. I don't know if you can get – if you go to a library, you may be able to get access to either Westlaw or one of the alternatives. There are a bunch of legal services that give you case law and would go into some of that stuff. Again, that's not going to be the easiest thing to do as a layperson, but it's certainly worth exploring. The thing, other thing I would do is there are at least a couple of – obviously, University of Minnesota has a law school. I believe Hamline and one of the other schools have combined and have a law school in the Twin Cities. I'd follow up, check with the law schools and see if they have a project. We do here where there may be a legal aid project where people will help with civil cases, where you'd get law students who are supervised by a lawyer or a professor who might be willing to help or at least give you some information. And, you know, I think that I would explore that at least and see if that might be available to you, because adverse possession is a it's simple enough in conception. The notion is that if somebody has land, possesses it, uses it, and even though it belongs to you, you don't say anything about it over a certain period of time, maybe 10 years, maybe 20, whatever it might be, that they have adversely possessed the land and therefore have a right to that land. There are all sorts of caveats. It has to be open and hostile and obvious. You know, there are a bunch of thick hoops they have to jump through to prove adverse possession. But again, anytime, never want to discourage anyone from representing themselves. And hiring a lawyer for something like this can certainly be expensive. But doing this on your own, if, especially if they have a lawyer, which I assume they do, is really difficult. Small claims courts, if that's what this is, are pretty good about it. Judges, I think, actually make an effort to try to balance the scales in that situation, but they're only going to go so far. So check with the law schools and see if they can offer you some help, at least some advice, if not actually help with representation. And then if failing that, like I said, go to the library, ask the librarian about, tell her you have some legal questions and ask her what resources they have.
I think that's very good advice, Mike. Good luck, Mary. Appreciate your call. And adverse possession can come up a lot of different in a lot of different ways. There's been quite a few just in the Madison area regarding driveways.
Yeah, and easements, and that's another form of adverse possession. You have, it's called an easement by prescription, which just means you don't really have a legal right except you've been doing it for so long that the courts say, well, okay, then that must mean that you're entitled to it. But you're right, and those things are very frustrating for people because they say, it's my land. I didn't give them permission. I didn't sell them anything. And why should I have to allow them now to either own this or access it?
And sometimes it comes when you buy a property that somebody else had been using the previous owner, and now you don't want that to happen. And there's all kinds of little ways that adverse possession
You're absolutely right, Larry. And again, the law, the basic law is fairly straightforward, but as always, the devil's in the details, and you really do need to try to get some help.
Luke in Chippewa Falls, we go to you next. Hi, Luke.
Hi. Back to the rent-a-car stuff.
Yeah, sure.
So we have full coverage on several cars. We rent cars a lot, and we always decline the insurance, even after their little scare tactics they tell you. The latest one I've been getting is that even though we decline it, we are still on the hook for the lost rental car fees for however long the car is in the shop. Is there any truth to that, and or is there any teeth behind that if it is true?
There is some truth to it, and I'm glad you raised it because it was one of those things I just, in doing the summary, didn't think to talk about. One of the things the agent I spoke with told me is that even if your company covers everything else, they may not cover the downtime, the loss of use. The other element could be diminution of value, which means that the car having been repaired may be worth less. I don't think that's a great claim for a rental car company, and I wouldn't be terribly worried about that. The downtime's, you know, a bit more of a concern. Again, a lot of companies will cover that, so you should check with your own company and see what they have to say about that. But that's something that you should check on in advance. Again, at some point, you know, you're just, it's like anything else. You're kind of weighing cost versus benefit, and you're saying, how likely is that to happen? You know, fender bender, the downtime's couple, 3 days. I think they'd not only have to show that there was downtime, they have to show that they really could have rented that car, which isn't a sure thing either. We all go to the airports and see the 400 cars sitting there, and they certainly don't rent all of them every day. So I think that, would they actually chase it? I don't know. Is there a risk? Sure. You know, of course, they might choose to do it. I don't know how far they'd pursue it if you chose to resist. But the simple answer is check with your own company. If they say, don't worry, we'll take care of that, then it's not a concern. If they don't, then again, you just have to weigh the cost against the potential risk you're running.
Yeah, good points. Thanks, Luke. Appreciate the call. Valerie in Rice Lake, your turn.
Hi. I have a rental car question. I take the insurance when I rent a car because I was told that if the car is stolen, if I have the rental car company insurance, it'll be covered. I won't have to pay for it. But if I don't have that insurance, I will have to pay for the cost of the car. Any comment?
Yeah. I don't think that's true. But, you know, again, I check with your own insurance company. The difference is we've been talking a lot about collision coverage, which is damage that's done to the vehicle, you know, while you're driving or for that matter, when it's sitting. Comprehensive coverage is a little different. That would cover, you know, if a tree branch fell on it when it was parked somewhere or if it was stolen. I mean, that falls under comprehensive coverage. I don't think it's different, honestly. I think your company would likely cover it, but it's always best to check with your own insurance company and be sure. And I don't know if the agent is telling you that or if this is just coming from somebody else who had a bad experience or is just concerned about it. But I definitely, I'm skeptical that that would happen. It'd be interesting to see the rental car contract, see what they do. Generally, you know, you're a Bailee, okay? And that's another wonderful old English legal term. But you're a Bailee, which means somebody else gave you something and you're in possession of that. In this case, you rented it. But you've got possession of that vehicle. Now, if you leave the keys in it and it's stolen, clearly you're responsible for that. If you don't do anything and somebody comes in the night and breaks in and hotwires the car or do whatever they do these days, then, you know, legally you could be responsible for that. The question is, does the insurance contract that you sign say somehow that you're going to be responsible for that no matter what happens? I would have problems with that. Again, whether that's enforceable, it could be, but I'm a little skeptical it would be. But the biggest thing I would do is check with your own insurance agent from your company. And incidentally, quick plug, I am not a fan of buying coverage online. I know a lot of people do. I deal with those companies all the time. Some of them are fine. Some of them aren't. It's not that they're, you know, not legitimate companies, but this is a good example of the problem is if you want to call GEICO and ask about this, I'm not quite sure you're going to get a good answer. If you're buying from an agent, whether it's an agent who's captive with, you know, one company like State Farm or American Family or an agent who sells a bunch of different companies, you know, I sell West Bend, Progressive, a bunch of companies that write through independent agents. You just have somebody who can probably answer these questions for you, which to me is a real benefit.
Yeah, makes sense. Valerie, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, up next. Hi, Vern.
Oh, hi. Good. Thanks for letting me on. Many years ago, it was 1971 or 70, that I read about Supreme Court decisions on vehicles. And I read that under insurance law, some Supreme Court decision back in the 1880s said all insurance contracts must be written so that the man of ordinary means and intelligence can understand them. In other words, in plain text. And they're not being written that way.
Yeah.
Well,
so I don't know.
Let me just quick, Vern, jump in. It's a good, really good question, and it's a problem. I worked for a couple of companies years and years ago, and I actually rewrote all their policies in what we call plain talk. And some more companies have done that, but the language is still daunting for a lot of people. I mean, it's not you say, well, read your contract, but you can read your contract, and how much people will understand about that is open to question. What the law says is exactly what you said. The law says that if there is an ambiguity in a policy, in other words, if two people of reasonable intelligence reading the policy could differ about what it means, then the benefit always goes to the insured. So the contract will always be construed in favor of the insured or somebody seeking coverage under that contract. There was a case that came down much more recently, although, you know, still probably 20 years ago now, where they said that the policy should be written with crystal clarity. And that was language that, as a plaintiff's lawyer who represents folks who are injured, I loved, and all of us use that. And predictably, the courts kind of backed away from that a little bit and said, well, we didn't really mean crystal when we said clarity. We meant pretty clear, not muddy, you know, but not murky, but not really crystal. Not you could drink from it, not that kind of thing. And so, you know, that's – but the bottom line still is that policies have to be written so that a reasonably intelligent person can understand what they say. And if there's a dispute about that, if reasonable people would say, boy, I think this, but I think that, then the company is supposed to provide coverage under those circumstances.
There we go, Vern. Thank you so much. Someone else was interested in the area of personal injury, and we should talk about personal injury. You know, we've talked about accidents here. How would you kind of define personal injury? What exactly is it?
Well, you know, personal injury is kind of what it sounds like. You're involved in an accident. It's someone else's fault because that's the key in terms of bringing a personal injury claim, and you suffer an injury, and it could be a relatively minor injury or it could be an awful injury, and, you know, we see both. You know, Wisconsin law says that if you're in an accident and someone else is more than 50%, is 50% or more at fault, then you have a right to recover. If your right to recover, if you're in some measure responsible, then whatever damages you recover are reduced by your measure of responsibility. So you have an accident and you go to a court and the court says, okay, the other side's 70% responsible, but you're 30, then a jury would award you whatever damages they believe you're entitled to, and then you'd subtract 30% from that. So that's comparative negligence, and that's the way our system works. The things that I'm always concerned with personal injury are these. You know, insurance companies, you have to understand, they don't represent you. They have no legal obligation to you at all. When you're in an accident, somebody else causes it, they're responsible to their insured, the person who caused the accident. They're not responsible to you. They have to pay you, and if a jury says they have to pay you X dollars up to the liability coverage the person has, they have to pay that. But on the way along, they don't have any obligation to deal fairly with you. When your own company's dealing with you, they have an obligation of good faith and fair dealing. So if you have an uninsured motorist claim where somebody without insurance injures you, your company's dealing with that, they have to treat you fairly. Whether they will or not is another issue, but they have a legal obligation to do that. When you're dealing with, if I'm in an accident and the other person's insured by American Family's responsibility is to that person, not to me. They have a responsibility not to expose him to damages beyond his coverage. So if he's got $50,000 in coverage and I'm willing to settle for that and they say, no, we're not going to do that, and I go to trial and get $100,000, then they've got a problem because they've exposed their insured to liability. And that can be a real problem for them. But in most cases where that's not an issue, and it's not in the majority of cases, their goal is to settle that case as cheaply as they can. And they don't, you know, you're not their insured. They don't care about you. They may be, some adjusters are very nice and very polite and some aren't, but regardless of their manners, their goal is to get that case settled. And what happens all too often and what concerns me is this, is that people and all these myths about everybody's out there and they've got their hand, it's rubbish. You know, I deal with Wisconsin people. I don't know what happens in L.A., but I can tell you here, my clients come in and are embarrassed to even be talking to a lawyer a good share of the time. And the vast majority of them, virtually all, just want to be treated fairly. And people, when they're in an accident and are injured, want to get better. And we hope we're going to get better. And nobody ever wants to be in a position where they have a great claim, as I tell people. The great claims are good for lawyers. They're horrible for people because, you know, nobody wants to live with a bad long-term injury.
No.
But what the companies know, because this is what they do for a living, they know that if they can get in early and talk to the person and get the case settled, and they often will come in and say, well, we'll take care of your medical bills. We'll take care of all the bills for the next 6 months, and we'll give you, you know, $1,500 or $2,500 or a relatively nominal amount. And often people, when you're in an accident, you're injured, you're hurting.
Not thinking right.
So you're not. And sometimes, usually what happens is often people don't notice an injury at the time of the accident. You get an adrenaline rush and, you know, you're just, and you're kind of saying, gee, I think everything works. And you go to the ER and they tell you that you don't have any fractures, which is almost meaningless because 90% of my cases don't involve fractures. And the real problems are long-term soft tissue issues in most cases. And so people feel worse for a while, then they start feeling a little better. And it's easy to think, okay, I'm going to be fine. So I just want to be done with this. I don't want to fool with this. I'm just going to settle. And people take a relatively nominal offer, and then 6 months later, they realize they haven't gotten better, and they're still living with some of this stuff. In Wisconsin, the classic is that you get injured in the winter, and you go for a couple months, and you know you're feeling a little better, and you think, well, I'll be okay. You get to the spring, and now you're playing golf, playing softball, biking, canoeing, whatever you're doing, and all of a sudden, you say, oh, wow, that really bothers me when I do that. And so for all kinds of reasons, what I always tell people is this is, one, never said, you know, in my mind, it's foolish to settle a case without at least talking to a lawyer. I talk to people all the time. They ask what they should do. I give them advice. If it's something they can do, I'll tell them that. Lawyers don't have a big interest in being involved in a case where it's a minor temporary injury, but I'm happy to talk to people about it and give them some advice. And a lot of lawyers will do that. There's no charge for that. I just think to settle a case, I mean, if you're better the next day and you go for a month and you're sure you're better and you don't, you sprained your ankle and now you're absolutely fine, that's one thing. But if you have any question at all about whether you're completely recovered, you just should never be settling a case with the insurance company without at least talking with a lawyer. And that's not self-serving because, like I said, a lot of these cases aren't cases that make any sense for a lawyer economically. But that doesn't mean that a good lawyer won't at least talk to you and give you some thoughts about what to do. The other concern, Larry, is I wrote a big note to myself, SOL, which meant something else to me when we were a kid. You know, there was an expression that was like that. But yeah, and it sort of applies here. SOL is a statute of limitations. There are limitations of time on when you can bring a lawsuit. Most personal injuries are 3 years. Wrongful death is 2. Property stuff is 6. There's a bunch of different ones. But again, don't let things go for more than, you know, 6 months to a year. I just talked to someone who the company strung along and strung along and strung along. And some companies will do that. Others will not. But some certainly will. And she got to the point where now her statute is run and she has no right to do anything. Oh. And if she talked to me and she said, gosh, I wish I'd call you. And I said, yeah, I wish you had too, because I could have given you that advice early on and this wouldn't have happened. We hear that a lot. We also hear all the time, gosh, I settled this and now I'm really having problems and I just didn't get enough money. And I hate to hear that because it is unfair. These things, people don't understand how much these injuries can impact your daily life in all sorts of ways. And to have to live with that, and then nobody's really fairly compensated, in my view. I mean, nobody given a choice wouldn't say, put me in a time machine, run me back before, and let me not have this happen, and everybody can keep their money. I don't care. But the bottom line is you need to be treated as fairly as the system allows. And to do that, you have to make sure you understand what claims are worth, what your rights are.
Mike Riley, our guest today, great to have him along as we talk about all kinds of things here. We've visited about personal injury. We've talked about car insurance and rental insurance. Take some other things as well. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll be getting to Ron in Manitowoc County and Mark in Black River Falls. You can join in, too. I'm Larry Mealer here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at some legal issues today with Mike Riley, Madison attorney. He's a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. Great to have Mike back. And our lines are all filled, so we'll go back to the phones. Ron in Manitowoc County, it's your turn. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you, Larry. Some general thoughts, Mike, on when an individual should consider a trust or will for transferring an estate or any other methods you may have in mind.
Ron, thanks for the question. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have much of an answer. The little summary on our screen says, what is best, a trust or a will? And my first thought is, what is best is not trusting Mike Riley for advice on either of these, because it just really is outside my area. We have a lot of people in our firm that do this kind of thing. I mean, there's two things involved. Obviously, you know, people who do this have told me that, I mean, one, tax consequences are a big thing. So, you know, you need to talk to a lawyer who understands those and or an accountant, but probably a lawyer. I think trusts were oversold for a while, at least in my view. I know there's a big push, but again, it just isn't my area. I'd talk to a lawyer and get some advice. It shouldn't cost much money at all to get somebody to make some recommendations about whether you're better off with a trust or a will. It's highly individual, I'm sure, in terms of the amount of assets you've got and who you're passing them to. And I know there are generation skipping trusts. There are all these things out there. And they're all things that I really have very little knowledge of. So I would not give you advice on which to do other than to tell you I'd find a good lawyer and talk to him about it.
There we go, Ron. Thank you for calling. Mark in Black River Falls, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a general question, I hope. And I am concerned about an issue I'm going through. And I was prescribed a medication. I took the medication as prescribed. and found out I am 1% worldwide allergic to it. And the resulting from it was a diagnosis of drug-induced aseptic meningitis, which has left me pretty much, I have brain damage. I have other issues which are long-term and will never go away. Is there a legal issue there, or is that something that's just basically, well, tough luck? Enjoy your life.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. That's horrible. Well, there are a bunch of issues there, and so I'll try to unpack them. First of all, I mean, likely there's no liability on the part of the doctor. We already talked about the difficulty of those cases. And again, you're in a situation where you're a part of a relatively small portion of the population that can have this reaction to this drug. And so unless there's something out there suggesting that or recommending that the doctors warn and that they go through a thing, unless you had any kind of history of allergic reactions to things that might have alerted the doctor, if that's not so, and I suspect it's not, then you probably don't have a claim against the doctor. Although, again, it never hurts to talk to a lawyer about these things. I mean, you obviously have an extremely serious injury. So, you know, it's worth exploring and it's worth talking to someone about. There are a lot of good firms in the state. I'd reach out to somebody and get some advice on that and to see about that. But again, I think the doctor's probably not likely going to be liable. The question then becomes the drug company and what they've done. One of the difficulties is we all see the ads on TV. And after everybody's, you know, rollicking and skipping and laughing and dancing because they've had this wonderful drug, then they give you this laundry list of 100 things, including yes. death and your left leg falling off that might well happen if you take the drug. And so, you know, then they, of course, say, well, there's warnings. And I don't know if the drug itself would be interesting. I mean, did the prescription itself, any of the information you received with it, suggest that you might have this, that suggests that this kind of reaction or this risk existed?
Well, in my case, there were issues where I was prescribed one painkiller and I developed symptoms. So it was kind of red flags going off, and they would constantly switch my medications to try and get something to deal with the pain. I've got degenerative disc disorder where I have fractures, multiple fractures in my vertebrae.
Oh, Lord.
And it's difficult. It's, you know, but...
Yeah. Yeah.
And willy-nilly, I was getting a painkiller, and then, oh, okay, no, this is when you're getting sick here. No, okay, we're going to change this because, wait, can you see? No, okay. Well, your balance is off. Okay, we'll try this one. So my issue was there are tests which can be done. You can take a blood panel across for an allergies, and that also applies to drug use. I have found that out, but when I do go approach an attorney, I'm getting it treated like a hot potato. No one wants to touch it. If I could leave my contact information, if somebody could get back to me, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I said, Mark, that's what you're seeing is exactly what I described before. These cases are so difficult. They're extremely expensive and people don't like to go near them. The defense is real simple. They're going to say, well, it's only, you know, this is a very rare reaction and we don't see it routinely. Yes, we'd switched him from other drugs. He'd never had a problem like this. I mean, we'd switched him from drug to drug. And, yeah, there were some reactions. And, you know, gosh, we were just trying to help. We wanted to find something that would, you know, give him relief from his pain. And, gosh, folks, you know, that's what we were trying to do. And there was nothing from any of the other drugs that indicated something like this could happen. And I'm not defending it at all, Mark. I'm just telling you that's the kind of thing you're going to hear. And I think that makes it tough. I would certainly talk to somebody about whether there's any – usually what happens is if a drug is causing problems in a significant enough group of people, then often you'll have either a number of lawsuits that are consolidated in what they call multi-district litigation, or you'll have a class action. Mm-hmm. And if something like that exists, it's a lot easier to get signed up for that because the costs and everything are being spread out over a large group of people. And so a case that – many lawyers might not take as an individual case, you might easily be able to get someone to take as part of a class action or if there's multi-district litigation. I don't know that's the fact, but again, I think you could check with lawyers. You know, I don't generally because, you know, I do this stuff and others do it. There are firms I like and firms I don't like. We don't get into that on the air. The one thing I would say is that, you know, the Habish firm is the largest personal injury firm in the state. They're very capable lawyers. If you haven't spoken with that firm, I would certainly not hesitate to recommend that you speak with someone there. And I think you'd probably get as good advice as you're going to get anywhere on something of this sort, particularly because this is much more complicated. And for most lawyers who are just running either general practice or a relatively small personal injury practice, this is, you know, may well be beyond what they're willing or able to take on.
There we go. Good luck, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Bob in Franklin has something for us, so let's go there. Bob, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I noticed when I buy products or deal with a business, if you go through their literature, many times they'll have an arbitration clause.
Right.
And if you don't read that literature, what they do is they tell you you have to send a letter if you want to opt out. I'm sure most people don't even know about the clause, don't send a letter, or get busy. Can they, force you into arbitration if you don't want to?
Well, there's just a Supreme Court case on this not too long ago. It was a little different context. It was it dealt with employees, and the employees had signed an arbitration clause. The question was whether that was enforceable, and I think ultimately the court concluded it was. You know, I think you're pointing to a much broader problem, Bob, in a lot of ways, and that is what we all see day to day. You go and you get an app, or you go on a website, and the first thing they do is, read the terms and conditions, which, of course, we all scroll through in 1 second, and then it says, I agree, and you punch, I agree. And the question is, are you bound by that? Is that, in fact, a contract? Are you agreeing to that? I think it's an issue you're going to see a lot of litigation on in the next few years. I've been involved in some of it. We've had some success with that. To claim that that's a contract the same way something is when you sit down and they give you something and you read through it, or at least should read through it and sign something, is to me really suspect, because obviously that's just not what anyone's doing nowadays with these kinds of things. I don't know anybody in the world who reads through. And obviously the bottom line is, if you did read through, what are your options? And that's the problem with these things, is these are what used to be called contracts of adhesion, which simply means that one side's got all the bargaining power and the other side has none. And the courts often refuse to enforce those because they said, look, the whole notion of a contract is that two parties and have a meeting of the minds and have an open discussion and have a chance to evaluate what they're agreeing to and then reach an agreement. None of these things, including the arbitration clauses, meet those tests at all. And so much of what happens on the internet, and I know this may not be on the internet, but so much of what happens on the internet is exactly that. If you simply buy a product and there's something somewhere in the packaging that says that, do I think that's enforceable? Probably not. If you actually sign something, whether you sign it physically or you sign it electronically, that's a different issue, and that can be a real problem. But again, the difficulty all of us have is, so if you decide you want that product or that service or whatever, you either sign up or you don't get it, and it's as simple as that. But I don't like it. I think it's a really unfortunate trend, and it's just one more of the many ways in which consumers' rights have been progressively lessened and companies' rights have been strengthened.
Yeah. There you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. I was thinking about some of those terms and conditions. I mean, they're like 4 feet long and this very dense copy, and you can barely read it. And, you're all right. Am I going to click yes?
Yeah. No, I do the same thing, Larry. And I mean, I know we're doing, and I can tell you that in one case we were involved in, we were able to persuade the court that it wasn't binding. I think it's debatable. I don't think the answer is that it's automatically binding. But the fact is that, unfortunately, the courts do enforce them, at least in some contexts.
Let's go to Randy in Norwalk. Randy, hi.
Good morning. I was injured in a accident at my employer, and I was ran over by a semi-trailer, and the doctor wrote me a disability, okay, then the insurance company that I was dealing with gave me a settlement over a period of 4 years. But down the road, 4 years from now, I'm still going to have the same discomfort and pain that I have now today. Is there anything I can do?
It depends. First of all, workers' comp, normally when you're injured in the course of employment, workers' compensation is the only remedy you have against your employer or against a co-employee, you know, who also works for the same employer. So if, you know, this is somebody who worked for the company and they cause you an injury, then probably the only recourse you have is workers' comp. Whether you've been properly compensated is another issue, and you should talk to a lawyer about that if you haven't, if what you've gotten is fair. Comp's a funny system. It's scheduled. They give you certain, you know, compared to disability at the waist, and it's just a system I don't work in much, but it's very different. If that person worked for a third party, you know, if you could show that the person who injured you worked for someone else, for another, a trucking firm other than, you know, your employer, then you'd have a right of what they call third-party action. So you could bring a claim against them. You could recover just as you could in any personal injury case. And that's a different situation. So what you need to do is talk to a lawyer and find out whether there's a third-party action there. Yeah. And that would give you additional compensation.
Thank you, Randy, for calling. Mike Riley, our guest today, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. He's going to be with us up until 12:30. Today, and so we'll take a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Mike. Stay with us. Taking a look at some legal issues today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Mike Riley, Madison-based attorney. He's with the Axley Law Firm, where he is a senior partner. He's done this for us many times, and so always great to have him come by. We've talked about insurance. We've talked about personal injury. We've kind of taken a variety of questions here. If you have one, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Claire emailed to say she was traveling in Italy in October and arranged a car rental here in the USA for over there. The rental company charged her an extra 60 euros this January because they said Italian police needed her information for an infraction. They said the fee was for providing the information. Claire has yet to get a ticket from Italy. The rental company had her information, so she is unclear as to why they would charge for giving the information.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't know either. Sounds like a scam to me. Yeah. Make a few extra bucks. I don't see any justification for that. They had her information. If she'd gotten a citation, she would have known it, I'm sure. I mean, even if it was a parking ticket. But you know, I can't imagine what the justification for that would be. It does raise another question, and that's it. I'm glad that Claire raised this. And that is, if you know, we've been talking about car rental, and I guess I've just assumed we were talking about the U.S. I've rented cars abroad on one memorable occasion, and in Ireland, I managed to, after my wife had told me for, I don't know, 3 days that I was driving too far to the left, and like every guy, I knew she was wrong and that I was driving appropriately. And I probably had been up till the moment I sheared off the side view mirror on the left side of my car. Yeah. So, you know, if you're abroad, the rules may not apply. Your company, most companies have what they call extraterritorial limitations on coverage. So, again, if you're going to go abroad, make darn sure your insurance company, if you're going to rely on that, says, yes, we will cover you. I think a lot of the credit card companies will cover you if you rent a car abroad using the credit card. But again, check with them before you go, because the rules they play by there aren't necessarily the rules we play by here.
Yvonne emailed that her insurance company's been charging her for home insurance based on having an asphalt roof, whereas she has a metal roof. This has been going on since 1997, and the insurance company is giving her the runaround because she's been overpaying based on the fact they've been charging her based on the type of, in part, on the type of roof she has. And I have, apparently, an asphalt roof. They charge more for that than they do for a metal roof normally.
Yeah, that could be. That doesn't shock me. I mean, one, I don't know. This goes back 22 years, so you're probably back. You can't go back that far, likely. You probably can go back about six. If she's talked to the company and they won't do anything, I'd at least file a complaint with the Office of the Insurance Commissioner. They, frankly, in my view, used to be a lot better about doing things than they are now. They tend to just sort of the company writes back and says, well, it's a dispute. And they say, it's a dispute. You know, we can't do anything. But I still think it's worthwhile, and it may prompt the company to do something. And, you know, that's something you can sue a company. Again, the wonderful world we live in, there's 10,000 limits on a small claim generally, but with insurance companies, it's five, which is, you know, a little bit of special interest treatment. But the bottom line is you could sue them for 5,000 in small claims court. They're going to then, you know, have to defend that. They generally aren't real eager to do that. And that's simple and straightforward enough so you could probably handle it yourself. So I'd go back to the company and tell them, look, one, if we get something done, I'm going to file a complaint and I'm going to file a lawsuit. And hopefully that'll move them. And if it doesn't, I'd do both.
Dan in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question for you. My mother, who recently passed away, was in a nursing home. Hospice had diagnosed or given orders to dispense morphine to the people at the nursing home.
Yep.
It wasn't dispensed correctly. And this happened for a couple of days. They were supposed to be dispensing once an hour, and they did once a day. Is there any repercussions that I should be looking at for any pain or suffering because she wasn't the medicine wasn't administered as directed?
I just honestly, Dan, if that's the period of time we're talking about, a couple of days, nobody's going to take that claim. You could certainly go to the nursing home ombudsperson, you know, patient relations person to see if they'd be willing to do something. They're not going to be willing to do much. And honestly, I just don't think that's enough to justify a lawsuit. If it somehow led to her death or caused some longer term problems, that would be a different issue. But again, if we're talking about it, and look, I'm not minimizing that. It's awful. You know, we all love our parents to pieces. And, you know, when they're in that situation where they're relatively helpless, to have somebody not provide appropriate care is really deeply disturbing. But that said, I just don't think there's enough there to justify pursuing a claim. You could certainly, you know, you can file a complaint too there. I mean, there's examining boards that regulate the nursing homes and things, and you can certainly file a complaint, which they won't like and which at least may give you some measure of satisfaction. But in terms of pursuing a claim for financial compensation, I don't think it's there.
There you go, Dan. Thank you for calling. Robin emailed that she recently bought a car and the dealership gave her a loaner until her car arrived. The dealership said they did not insure the car while she was using it and that she needed to call her insurance to make sure that was covered. When she called her insurer, they said they did not insure such situations and that the dealership loaning the car should give her an option for coverage. Were they right? What should she have done in that situation to make sure she was covered?
Well, she did the right thing in calling her agency, and frankly, I'm surprised. I'm assuming that she had traded in her car, from what she says, and was getting another car. In that case, you know, even though this might not be, it should be one of two things, either a temporary substitute vehicle, which would be covered, or you've got a period of time in which you buy a new vehicle, you have up to generally 30 days in the policies, you know, to advise the company that you're purchasing a new vehicle, and they provide coverage, you know, for that length of time. I mean, it's important ultimately to let them know and sooner rather than later. But generally speaking, most policies provide that coverage. I'm skeptical that they would not cover it. And I'm not sure if they were talking about which coverages they were talking about, whether they say clearly she certainly would have liability coverage under her policy. I mean, I can't imagine that wouldn't be the case. The question would probably be collision and comprehensive. And again, I would have thought the company would provide coverage for that under those circumstances. I don't, you know, I mean, the dealership I deal with locally gives me loaners all the time, and I sign something and they have insurance, but they certainly, you know, I sign up for my insurance. My insurance will cover it. I checked. I'm insured with West Bend and they cover it. I'd be really surprised if her company didn't, and I'm not sure she's not getting bad advice. one concern you have, and I see this all the time, is insurance agents, and again, I've already told people you should contact your agent, and you should. Insurance agents come in all shapes and sizes, just like lawyers, doctors, and everything else. And some of them are really good, and some of them really aren't. And it's I talk to agents all the time and insurance adjusters all the time who have no idea what the law is. They think they know, but they don't. And, you know, with an independent agent, again, they represent multiple companies. And, you know, I'd want if they're saying that, I'd say then please give me a contact person at the company itself. I want to talk to them and make sure I understand what's covered and what's not.
Yeah. Well, that makes good sense. We'll go to an email from Erica. By the way, you can join in. A question we'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Erica emailed that her father filed for separation from his wife in 2001. They still live together at the same address, and everything is basically the same as before the separation was filed. If her father was to pass, would his wife still be the sole beneficiary of his estate if there's no will in place?
Well, the question, you started by saying they filed for separation, and separation and divorce aren't the same thing. And yeah. I'm assuming that she, if it's a divorce and they filed and they're divorced, that's a different thing. I mean, the fact that you're living together, she's not his wife anymore if they're divorced. Now, the separation thing, and I, again, we're now talking an area that I have dealt with, but not for years and years. I'm not sure that there is any more a legal separation available. My impression was there hadn't been for some years. But again, it's not my field. The real question is, are they married? If they're married and he has no will and he dies intestate, which means without a will, yeah, she's going to get everything because that's what happens to begin with. There are no minor children, I assume, and that sounds like there aren't here. But that depends on whether they're married or not. If they're not married, the fact that they're cohabiting probably doesn't make a difference. We don't have common law marriage. Whether you could bring a suit or not, that, again, it's just an area of the law. I'm not familiar enough to know. But in general, the answer is if they're not married, they're not married. She's not a spouse. She probably doesn't get things. I would want to make sure I understood what their actual legal status is. And then if you wanted better advice on it, I'd talk to a lawyer who does divorce law or family law.
Carol in Randolph, it's your turn now. Hi, Carol. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. 7 months ago, my son was working as a carpenter, and he had a nail ricochet into his eye. So I'm assuming we should see a lawyer, but I'm wondering what your advice is. And the other thing is I can't afford a lawyer, and I've been wondering about lawyers that get paid afterwards and what you think about that. I don't know if there's any difference.
Yeah, that's a great question, and probably something I should have discussed. One, I think you can talk to a lawyer. Most personal injury lawyers are not going to charge you a fee for talking to you and giving you some advice and basically determining whether or not they can help you. Two, injury lawyers, should work on a contingency fee basis, which means they don't charge an hourly fee. You don't have to pay a retainer. You don't need money up front. They get a percentage of what they recover for you in the end. So that shouldn't be any obstacle to hiring a lawyer. The big question at work, we talked about a little before, is if this is something that has to do with the employer, then the positive of workers' comp is whether anybody's at fault or not, you do get paid workers' comp. And so that is a positive thing. And something like this could say maybe this is, a piece of wood had a knot in it or something, and that's what caused this, but it was really not the employer's fault, not your son's fault, and he would still get workers' comp. If there's something wrong, if the nail gun, or if there's something you can show that a third party, somebody other than the employer, was negligent and caused this injury, then a lawyer could help with that. Lawyers also do workers' comp. And, it's often good to have a lawyer do the workers' comp, at least consult with you, because even though it's scheduled and it's a very different thing than personal injury, that doesn't mean that there can't be more or less money paid. There's money for disfigurement. There's a bunch of things that might apply here, and you really should talk with a lawyer that does workers' comp. They also work on a contingency basis.
Yeah, makes good sense. Carol, thank you. Billy in Wataka, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Billy.
Hi. I'm an artist, and I had an exhibition in New York City at a nonprofit, And when they took the work down, it was extremely damaged, and they've admitted to them being at fault in the hanging and the bringing it down, and that they think that they should do something about it, but they keep dragging their feet. The show ended in November, and I still haven't gotten anything from them.
That's a shame. I mean, you'd hate to have any property damaged, but artwork which you create and put your heart and soul into, to have that damaged is really, really distressing. They clearly are – if they admit they're negligent, then they're clearly legally responsible. I'd go back to them, honestly, Billy, and just say, look, I've been very patient with this. I can't be patient any longer. I either need you to, you know, talk to me about this and work something out, or I'm going to hire a lawyer and bring a lawsuit. You could certainly talk to a local lawyer. The fact that it happened in New York, you may end up having to get a lawyer out there. That kind of adds a layer. But I'd start with a lawyer here, because they can hopefully either they can reach out to a lawyer there and, you know, associate with them, or they can get you a referral to somebody in New York who they know or some friends know. But I would give them a kind of 2 weeks or 30 days or whatever. I'd give them a short deadline and say, beyond that, I'm going to go to a lawyer, and then I would.
Billy, thank you very much for calling. Leo in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn.
Hi. Under a homeowner's policy, my mother-in-law was scammed, one of those phone scams where the, you know, granddaughter's in trouble and yep. go to Walmart and buy, you know, gift cards, whatever. Can we make a claim on the homeowner's policy under the theft, because she has that coverage? And if so, what's the time limit that we have to do that within?
It's likely 6 years, because it essentially damaged a property or damage to a property right. I certainly wouldn't wait, you know, longer than I'd say the shortest statute's probably 2 years. But again, I wouldn't wait at all. I mean, I'd go ahead. It certainly doesn't hurt to make a claim to the company. I'm honestly haven't seen that come up. My sense is they probably won't cover it. But again, it never hurts to go to the company. And anytime you're making a claim, if the company says it's not covered, don't just accept that at face value. Ask them to point you to the specific language in the policy that they say they're relying on to tell you that you don't have coverage. They're obligated to do that. That's something companies have to do. And never accept a turndown until they've shown you what in the policy entitles them to avoid coverage.
There you go, Leo. Thank you very much for calling. And you can join in too, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Katie in Milwaukee. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I was in a car accident driving someone else's car, and I was injured. So that company fulfilled their obligation to me to their maximum. Then it switched to my company, who I've talked to numerous times, but it's 8 months later. They still haven't made a payment. They just had me have an independent medical exam, and it was information they didn't get to me that they weren't getting what I gave them permission for. So I'm getting worried about them, A, paying for all the treatment I've had in 8 months.
Yeah.
And also whether they're looking at my actual medical records, which was a problem that they didn't get. I went and got them to them. And, you know, it would seem that covers the 8 months before this independent exam. So I don't know if that's something I should be consulting a lawyer for yet, or wait and see what's going to happen.
You know, I probably, as I've said, most good lawyers will talk to you and give you some advice, explain the situation. I think it's worthwhile consulting with a lawyer at this point. You shouldn't have to pay money for that, honestly. Somebody should be willing to take 15 or 20 minutes to, you know, listen to the problem and give you some advice. Who was at fault for the accident?
Well, I was the only person and the only vehicle in the accident.
Oh, okay. So it was a single car accident. And, you know, these things happen. But the bottom line is there's nobody else that you'd say was responsible for the accident, right? I mean, somebody else didn't crash into you or cause you to crash.
No.
Okay.
I was actually one of those, having a reaction to an over-the-counter drug.
Oh,
that shut my eyes like a steel trap.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, it's awful. Well, anyway, first of all, what you're talking about is medical payments coverage. Most people have it. It's not mandatory, but most people have it. It's often $10,000, sometimes as little as one. So it sounds like the car is always primary, as we've said a few times. So if you're driving somebody else's car, you go to that coverage first, then to your own. You've been to them. They paid you, was it $10,000 that they paid? Or
they paid $20,000, and carry $100,000 on my own.
Of $100,000 of medical payments coverage.
Mm.
Yeah,
because
that's really smart. It's really smart, Katie, because it's not that expensive. And boy, you know, the bills, as you know now, bills run up really quickly. I don't know. First of all, the IMEs are, I'm sorry, they're just whores. I mean, there's no other way to put it. 90% of the people who do these are not honest. They work for insurance companies. They give the same opinion time after time after time. There are people out there who I think are honest and objective. I just don't see them very often. We used to. Used to be a different thing. But boy, it's in this day and age, you know, those are not very reliable, which means in my mind that they may well turn you down and you're going to have to get a lawyer anyway, which is one more reason to just talk to somebody right now. I'd write the company again. I'd write the company, say, look, it's been a lengthy period of time. You know, since we submitted these claims, they haven't been paid. They have an obligation to pay within 30 days unless the claims are disputed. They're going to use the IME to dispute your claims, I'd be willing to bet, because that's why they have them. So, again, I'd go to a lawyer right now, but I'd write them a letter and just say I've been patient. You know, my patience has expired. I need you to take care of this, and if you're not, then I'm going to hire a lawyer and pursue it. Because there's enough money involved there so that certainly hopefully you can get a lawyer who will be interested in pursuing it and will take care of it on your behalf.
Now, there are one final quick one here. John emailed that his skid loader was damaged by lightning and his homeowner's policy company says it's considered outdoor equipment, so it isn't covered for full replacement cost. He's asking if there's a case to examine what falls under the definition of that phrase and recover the full replacement cost.
Yeah, I mean, I'd certainly, again, I'd ask them to point to the language. Sounds like they have. Sounds like they're saying this is why. I don't know if they're paying something but not everything, so if they're paying actual cash value. This sounds like it was repaired, so, I mean, that they should be just paying the repair costs, I would think. I don't think replacement would matter unless it was completely destroyed or it was constructive loss, because fixing it would have cost more than it would cost to replace it. But they need to point to the language. And again, we talked about ambiguity earlier. If they don't define outdoor equipment, you may have an argument. The difficulty is, and again, I'd look at the policy and see what that language is. Is that exactly what it says, is outdoor equipment? You know, I would view a skid loader, I don't see you probably using it in your basement. So, you know, I would think of it as outdoor equipment. But again, you need to look at the language of the policy. They need to tell you which language specifically they rely on.
And on that note, Mike, we are out of time. You'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
I'd love to.
Mike O'Reilly, Madison attorney. He is a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. It's always great to have him come by, and we will have him come back and talk. We'll pick a different aspect of the law, and we'll go from there. Just looking ahead, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll talk with turfgrass expert Doug Soldat. So get those lawn care questions ready. That's tomorrow at 11 and Saturday morning at 6, or online anytime. And join us this evening at 6 for a live call-in on Point Special on details of the Mueller report. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.